You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay, so we'll begin with this second session. Thank you very much for staying for this panel or coming to it. We discuss America First. That was the starting point of our discussion on the first session, on the first panel. On this second panel, we're going to be discussing alliances in the new normal of the U.S.-China rivalry. My name is Ramon Pacheco Pardo. I am the KFBUB Korea Chair, and I will be moderating this panel. And with me, I have three speakers. We are not missing anyone. It's three speakers, this panel. So we have an empty chair here next to me, and we have the three speakers to my left. I will introduce them, and then we'll do as before. We'll have a discussion among ourselves, so they will have a discussion among themselves, and then I will open up to questions from the audience. So immediately to my left, I have Lynn Kwok, who is actually a former Brookings expert, and right now she's a senior research fellow at Cambridge University. From January, she's going to be the Shangri-La Dialogue Senior Fellow for Asia Pacific Security at the IISS, where she's currently based also as an associate fellow of the Asia-Pacific program. And recently, she gave evidence on East Asian, Far Eastern affairs on the UK House of Commons Defence Committee. Then in the middle, we have Linda Desmele, who is a PhD researcher at the Institute for European Studies, with the Korea Chair as well. She was a trainee at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Belgium, and last year she was a visiting researcher at the School of Foreign Service here in Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. And to my far left, I have Shinbum Chul, who is the director of the Center for Security and Unification and the Asian Institute for Policy Studies. Before, he was director general for policy planning at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Korea between 2013 and 2016, and he has held advisory posts with the National Security Council, the National Assembly, and the Ministry of National Defense, all of them in South Korea. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to start maybe with Lynn, and I wanted you to discuss, we have this competition which is a structural between China and the U.S., and this has been intensifying over the past few years and with the current administration. So can you give us from an Asian perspective, how has Asia, East Asia, responded to this competition between the U.S. and China?
Well, I think the thing to say at the outset is that Southeast Asia is exceedingly worried about the intensifying competition between the United States and China. I think, broadly speaking, countries in the region welcome a firm U.S. approach to upholding a rules-based order in the region. As such, it's been generally supportive of U.S. freedom navigation operations in the South China Sea. It's also recently welcomed stronger statements by the U.S. State Department in terms of criticizing China's acts of encroaching upon Vietnam's exclusive economic zone since July through the use of seismic vessels. That said, what the region does not want to see between the United States and China is a no-holds-barred competition between the two superpowers because the region fears that it's going to become collateral damage in this great power competition. I think countries in Southeast Asia have generally responded to China's rise by seeking to hedge its bets. So what it's done is it's tried to broaden and deepen security ties with the United States, while at the same time pursuing the economic opportunities that China offers. What's happening with the intensification of U.S.-China rivalry, however, is that this is narrowing the region's strategic options. So while the United States insists that it's not making countries in Southeast Asia choose, between the two powers. What happens when the United States actually says that it will not share intelligence or work with countries that use Huawei equipment? Is that this is tantamount to giving countries an ultimatum to choose, even though it might not be said in so many words? But even if the region takes the United States at its word, when it says that it's not making the region choose, I think what will ultimately happen with a decoupling of economic and technological spheres in the case of deepening rivalry is that it becomes almost impossible for the region not to choose between the two countries. So as far as possible, in my view, I think countries need to stand by the rule of law and support a rules-based order without actually taking sides in many of these disputes. So it's to stand on the side of principles and the law rather than necessarily choosing one power over the other. But, you know, whether or not it has a wherewithal to do that moving forward is, of course, an open question, with the United States being perceived as a very fickle power, as well as China's increasing economic clout and therefore persuasive powers in Southeast Asia. So I'll stop there.
One point, you said it might become impossible not to choose.
Well, if there's a decoupling of, you know, the technological spheres or the economic spheres, then it really, if it's Huawei or no way, then you know, it's you have to choose, right?
And we'll get back to this, who might some Southeast Asian country choose or not, but I wanted to ask the same question to Linde. With a European focus, right? What are the views, responses in Europe about U.S.-China competition that has been intensifying over the past few years?
So I think in general, there are actually a lot of overlaps with what Lynn just mentioned, that Europeans also feel like they are kind of being forced or pushed to choose by both sides. On the one hand, China opposing this concept of alliances and seeking to create some sort of a vision for a common destiny, while at the same time, of course, the United States expecting the Europeans kind of to get tough on China and pressuring the Europeans on certain issues, such as it was already mentioned, 5G, etc. But I actually think that in response, what we have seen, and we've already kind of alluded to it in the previous discussion, is that Europeans, and by then I mean Europeans within the European Union, that they have very desperately tried not to pick a side, and that they've kind of, this competition has served to perhaps strengthen kind of the desire for some sort of European strategic autonomy. And I think to kind of, one could of course put into question the sustainability of such an approach or whether or not that is effective. But I think it depends very much on which domain or which sector you're going to look at. So if we try to, for example, subdivide this competition between the United States and China into different elements, if you look at, for example, the economic domain, which is arguably the domain in which the competition is the most visible and the most fierce at the moment, I guess you could say, well, in terms of economics, this is really an area in which the EU is or can be a formidable power. It's also an area in which the European Union has competences. So where it has, I would argue, where it does have some leverage over both the United States and China. And, of course, in the economic domain, Europeans share a lot of concerns with the U.S. when it comes to reciprocal market access, intellectual property rights, and all of that. But I think the United States is not making it very easy for Europeans to work with them, because at the same time, you also have the United States imposing tariffs against certain European countries or repeating threats to do so. So I think the EU kind of sees them as two problematic partners, given the current U.S. administration. And so there it's really tried to kind of stick to its own course by adopting an investment screening mechanism, by adopting a connectivity strategy, and all of that. If we then look at more the security realm, of course, there not picking a side becomes a lot more problematic, because there is the transatlantic security relationship, there is the alliance. So, of course, there Europeans are much closer to the United States. But there I think that in many European capitals, China is simply not or not yet really seen as like a geopolitical threat in the same way that the United States looks at China. Mm-hmm. So I think that the need to choose there also seems less pressing or less salient, precisely for the reason that the immediate security threat might be less obvious. And it was already mentioned also during the previous panel There are conversations about China now within NATO, but this is still rather exploratory, and it's not at all at the same, I guess, level as, for example, the Russia conversation. And then finally, more in political terms, so this, let's say, Washington model versus the Beijing alternative. There, obviously, it seems very logical for Europeans to align with the United States because we have so many things that bind us together. But there again, I think with the current administration, the EU has a very difficult relationship there because of, I guess, some ideological convictions that lead the current administration to be very openly Eurosceptic, to be supportive, openly supportive of the Brexit process. So there, also for domestic political reasons, certain European countries might not be all too willing to align with the United States. So I think, but as I said, we can get back to this later, you can put into question how sustainable it is, but at this point, the choice of Europe has been not to make a choice, I guess.
I wanted to move the discussion further and actually discuss from a South Korean, maybe Northeast Asian perspective. What do you think that both the U.S. and China are trying to achieve from this competition that has been ongoing for a number of years now?
Maybe the United States and China both seek the influence over the region. Traditionally, there is a word put South Korea's position. We always talk about the shrimp between the whale. Mm-hmm. The whale, one day, can be the United States and China. South Korea, we believe that we are weakest one between the big powers. Sometimes that becomes Japan or China. But when it comes to the U.S.-China competition, it makes us a more difficult position. As we know, probably the European country has the same position that we are U.S. alliance partners. So when it comes to the connectivities, it cannot compare to the that of the United States and that of China. Mm-hmm. We are U.S. side. However, because of Chinese economic influence, it's growing. South Korea's number one trade partner is China, not United States. That was 20 years ago. So we cannot but listen to China's voice to expand our economic prosperity. However, the China's economic cooperation always entails the political influence, frankly speaking. Best case was the year 2016, when South Korea deployed the third system. China levied heavy economic sanction on South Korea. Now, even the change of government in South Korea, China's economic pressure continues. So, the October 2017, our Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa pledged to our Congress, saying that our position of 3-0. We are not deploying more third system. We are not joining USMD, missile defense system. Mm-hmm. And we are not going to develop the trilateral security cooperation among Korea, United States, Japan into trilateral alliance. Mm-hmm. I think that's a mistake. But anyway, that is a kind of China's pressure continue and getting stronger and stronger. That's the problematic. So for South Korean perspective, I think we need a peaceful coexistence between the two big powers, which we enhance our national capability and national power, national interest, with a strong alliance system with the United States and peaceful economic cooperation with China. But that is the past. I think it will not happen again because of hardening competition. I think the position of South Korea getting harder and harder.
But I mean, you mentioned peaceful coexistence. I mean, it sounds very good, but we don't have peaceful coexistence right now, right? So where do you think South Korea is leaning? Do you think it's trying to get closer to China because of what we talked about before, the plans in the U.S.-ROK alliance, or do you think that this is really not going to happen?
Yes, in diplomatic areas, it's very difficult to lead between the lines. I believe that South Korea never leaned to China. Never. Maybe year 2015, when President Park Geun-hye visited the Tiananmen squares and sit beside the President Xi Jinping when the China celebrate their winning of World War II. So probably President Biden is the only leader come from the free world, which seek liberal international order. So many U.S. Specialists and Japan specialists asked me, at the time I was working at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs as a director of policy planning, asked me about South Korea, whether South Korea leaning towards China. My answer was no, that's not happened, because we have our own strategy to persuade China, to persuade North Korea. That's our strategy. Although that was a failure, as it turned out. However, because of our national interest, we are difficult to leaning toward China. Look at the Korea system. We are free democratic countries. Our respect of human rights is relatively high, I think. But the only reason we expand our cooperation is economic prosperity, but there is a limitation because the nature of economic cooperation with China is changing. 10 years ago, it's a very, I think, a reciprocal. Because of South Korea's money and high technology combined with China's cheap labor, we produce goods and then sell in the foreign market, like United States and Europe. However, because of China's development of its own technology, the economic situation, we are having more competition with China, not such kind of a cooperation with China. Mm-hmm. So maybe 10 years, people realize that South Korea never leaned towards China, and South Korea always fear China's political influence over the region, just like last 2,000 years, last 2,000 years, maybe.
Lina, I wanted to throw this question to you as well. I mean, you did mention that there is worry about the Chinese behavior in Southeast Asia, right? So can you talk a little bit more about what is the perception in Southeast Asia about what China is trying to achieve in the region? Is it hegemony, something different? And similarly, what is the perception about U.S. goals in the region as we speak?
Well, in terms of Chinese goals, despite what China claims about wanting a win-win outcome for the region, I think the region is quite clear about what it sees China's goals to be. And from their perspective, I think the first point they would think about is, first, China wants economic rights that it's not permitted to under international law, economic rights in these coastal states, exclusive economic zones. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, China wants to deny the United States and its allies their navy's access into much of the South China Sea. And number three, just outside of the South China Sea, what China is looking for is for Southeast Asian countries, when they make their foreign policy decisions, to take into account Chinese interests. So those are the three main goals I think the region sees China as seeking. They obviously find these goals objectionable, and you have countries like Vietnam trying to push back against China. So we saw in the last 3 months very tense for the last 3 months until last week when China withdrew its seismic vessel. We saw a very tense standoff between a Chinese seismic vessel as well as escort vessels and on the one hand and Vietnamese Coast Guard on the other hand when Vietnam was seeking to register protest at China's actions. But in a sense, in the region where the countries are very much smaller than China as well as much poorer than China, there's a degree of resignation in terms of how long and how far they can push back against China and to stem against the rising tide of Chinese influence and power. So the Philippines, under the Duterte administration, has adopted a far more conciliatory approach to China than the former administration. It's shelved the South China Sea Tribunal ruling, which largely ruled in the Philippines' favor, mm-hmm. and it's really focused its efforts in terms of seeking to conclude an agreement to cooperate in oil and gas development in the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. And in some respects, in fact, it's actually ceded ground to China. So in June, when a Chinese fishing vessel collided with a Filipino fishing vessel that was stationary, President Duterte came out quite early on to say, to explain the presence of the Chinese fishing vessel in the Philippines EEZ by saying that, oh, in 2016, he had agreed with China that China should be given rights to fish in the Philippines EEZ. Now, that was the first time anyone in the Philippines had heard that, but that just goes to show how far he was willing to go to normalize, in a sense, China's presence in the region. And, of course, earlier this year, for about 6 months or so, we had hundreds of Chinese vessels swarming Philippines-occupied territory in the South China Sea. And this might not have reached international attention if not for the fact that a U.S.-based think tank, the Asia Maritime Transparency Institute, brought it to the attention of the international media in February this year because the Philippines was keeping mum about it. So there is a certain degree to which, you know, countries in the region feel that there is very little that they can do, even if they wanted to do more. And Malaysia similarly has adopted an approach that has sought to minimize tensions between China and itself. I can talk about that a little bit more, but let's just leave it at that in terms of how countries in the region have responded to China's goals. In terms of how countries in the region perceive the United States' goals and how it's responded to them, like, I think what one can say is that there is no great degree of clarity in terms of what the U.S. goals for the region are. For instance, is the U.S. goal to ensure that China does not surpass it in power and influence in Southeast Asia or broader East Asia? Or would Washington be satisfied if it were to be able to ensure that China played by the rules? And so this lack of clarity, I think, is borne out in the trade dispute between the United States and China. So this started off really as a concern by President Trump over the trade imbalance between the two countries. And since then, it's really evolved into a more holistic problem with China's approach to its economy, including, you know, the theft of intellectual property, forced technology transfers, as well as unfair market access. And then beyond that, at a higher level, you know, some in the United States they demand that China address the outsized influence of state-owned enterprises. And even beyond that, there are some within the United States who would at least privately admit that their concern goes beyond mere economic rivalry, but the trade war is really a war by another means. It wants to be able to contain China's rise or push back against China's rise. Now, countries in the region respond to this rather nebulous group of goals by saying or by broadly supporting U.S. efforts to support a rules-based order, but they're really wary about U.S. actions that appear to be aimed at containing China. And I think a very good example of this would be the Singapore Prime Minister's speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue in June, when he said that, you know, attempts to use trade to keep one country down is very divisive and destabilizing, and he urged that countries, meaning the United States, cease such actions. And the United States, apart from having unclear goals which hurt its interests, is also hurt by a perception that it is not a very reliable ally. And I think the region has an experience of this. In 2017 and 2018, Vietnam received threats from China for drilling for oil and gas in Vietnam's own EEZ, and the United States was silent. And of course, we've had the recent episode where the United States withdraws from northern Syria without informing its Kurdish allies. And that has not played out well, I think, in other parts of the world, including Southeast Asia, where they're no doubt looking at this U.S. action and thinking, this could be me next. So I think I'll stop there.
But I want to follow on, actually, because you mentioned Malaysia, Vietnam, Philippines as well. What about Indonesia, which is the biggest country in the region, is a member of the G20? What is Indonesia's position vis-à-vis this rivalry?
I think Indonesia has always been, to a greater extent than, say, countries like Singapore, it's been more equidistant between the United States and China in any event. We take that factor into account, plus the fact that Indonesia also has great infrastructure needs. So Jokowi, President Jokowi's maritime axis, I think he seeks to build greater connectivity between the various islands in the Philippines. And for this, you need Chinese capital and money, because China seems to be the only power, or one of the few powers, that seems to be consistently willing to offer up some of these goodies. And so we had elections in Indonesia earlier this year. And in elections, President Jokowi was receiving great criticism from some of his rivals for being too close to China. But in the midst of these elections, we had Jokowi's close aide go to China with $91 billion worth of deals, saying, please, you know, are you interested in any of these infrastructure development deals within Indonesia? And I think this gives you a sense of where Indonesia would stand in any great power rivalry. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And now, Linda, if we look at Europe, we have seen a huge increase in Chinese investment in Europe, a 50-fold increase over a period of 10 years. We have the Belt and Road Initiative, which covers the whole of Eurasia all the way to Spain and Portugal. Right. So we see this increasing presence of China in Europe that we are not used to before the global financial crisis, for example. In your view, what are European views of what China is trying to do in Europe by increasing its presence in this dramatic way?
So I think first I would actually note that it's true that investments have gone up a lot, but actually, if I'm not mistaken, in the last 2 years they've also went down a little bit again for different reasons, also because of Chinese domestic, there's less supply, so to speak, and also because, as I already mentioned, certain European countries have become a little bit more skeptical of these investments. But so I think in this sense, the picture is a bit different between Europe and Asia, because I don't think that China wants to dominate Europe or wants to own Europe or wants to achieve some sort of hegemonic position there, while that might be more the case in Asia. But I think that from China's perspective, it would just make sense to neutralize kind of Europe, to neutralize Europe in when it comes to U.S. When it comes to its competition with the United States, because if the EU, of course, we can say that it's weak in some areas, it's strong in other areas, but it would be a very formidable partner for the United States in this competition with China. So I think what China seeks to do is basically to neutralize Europe. And how does it do that? Precisely through these investments and through some sort of divide and rule tactics. It seeks to kind of nurture some bilateral relations or relations with sub-regional groupings. And in this way, it kind of can make sure that whenever something comes up at the Council, that it can basically block it if it were negative for China's interests. And I think it's been kind of successful in doing that, because there have been already several instances where individual countries have refrained or have actually blocked statements that would criticize China on human rights practices. I believe that was Hungary. Or when it comes to the Chinese claims in the South China Sea, where once again the EU ultimately could either not set out a statement or really had to tone it down, because the EU on many areas is a consensus-based organization. And so I think there China has actually been quite successful. So I don't think it tries to own the EU, but if it can make sure that it stays somewhat divided and that it's not a credible or as credible as it could be in being a partner for the United States, then I think that's, from the Chinese perspective, a job well done.
Now, if we move to the U.S. and to give some background maybe to the audience, when President Trump came to the NATO summit last year, for example, in Brussels, in Europe there was fear. We didn't know what Trump was going to do once he came to the summit, right? There's a discussion about what is he trying to achieve with all these trade wars, potential for tariffs on German car makers, for example. What do you think are European views about what the U.S. is trying to achieve in Europe under the current administration, if anything?
This is a very good question. No, I think, in a sense, there's just the traditional goals of the United States in Europe by somehow, you know, maintaining open markets for U.S. Products and a good trade relationship and maintaining some sort of regional stability and all of that. But I think then what happens in the Trump administration, I think there are two layers actually added on top of what we tend to traditionally see when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in Europe, is that first, there's really an ideological element of really being very highly Eurosceptic, which is, of course, a big difference compared to the past in which the United States was always, although under certain conditions, rather supportive of European integration. And here I think this is really an ideological argument where the current administration is very skeptical of this. And as I already mentioned, supporting Brexit and all of that. So I think there's an ideological layer that you should add on top of it. And then there is, to bring it also back kind of to the title of the panel, the China layer also, which is added on top of it, that I think the United States is also starting to look at Europe kind of in what Europe could or could not do in terms of competing with China. And so there, the 5G would, of course, be, I think, an interesting example where we definitely see that the United States is pressuring Europeans not to go along with China here. And I think where the United States is also increasingly interested in seeing how Europeans position themselves vis-a-vis China, which is something that wasn't necessarily there in the past. So I think we have to add two layers on top of it, but then with a lot of like theatrics around of it, surrounding it.
And now, Bontul, in your case, if we talk about competition, some people have portrayed the Indo-Pacific strategy as a way to isolate China. And when President Trump went to Korea, South Korea, for the first time, he actually raised the Indo-Pacific in his address with President Moon. What is the South Korean approach to the Indo-Pacific strategy?
Maybe the President Moon's flagship diplomacy this time is a new southern policy, which means that because of the Northeast Asia is a red ocean, South Korea seeking blue ocean, so that is Southeast Asia and other Pacific countries. So Moon administration tried to expand the cooperation with ASEAN countries. And then already President Moon visited ASEAN three times, and then he visited almost all ASEAN countries. With regard to the free and open Indo-Pacific, South Korea was late to support the Indo-Pacific ideas, because the Moon administration inaugurated May 2017. But when it comes to South Korea's support of Belt and Road Initiative and Indo-Pacific strategy is totally different. South Korea, Moon administration supported Belt and Road Initiative in December 2017. But the Moon administration supported the Indo-Pacific last June, 1 year and a half later than supporting Belt and Road Initiative, because of fear of Chinese influence. But anyway, the term, the President Moon and the summit between the President Moon and President Trump said that the South Korea and United States seek the connection between their free and open in the Pacific and South Korea's new southern policy. Maybe there are several areas of cooperation. One is the capacity building of Southeast Asian countries. You know, frankly speaking, South Korea doesn't want a confrontation to China because we always kind of weak partners. We are probably getting suffer from Chinese economic sanction like that. Instead, we want to detour to help U.S. strategy. That is capacity building. For example, several years ago, South Korea sent its retired military vessel to certain country, and they used that military vessel to checking the China's fisher ship. That is a kind of South Korean effort to build the capacity in Southeast Asian country. We also have some kind of spend a lot of ODA to Southeast Asian country, and we can help those countries expand democracy and respect more human rights. I think that is a kind of a South Korean role to expand our cooperation with the United States. You know that the problem these days, I think, with regard to this kind of cooperation, maybe, you know, it is hard to criticize the current administration, but anyway, No, when it comes to the last administration, Obama administration, United States at the time rebalance strategy, mm-hmm. That entails, that emphasizes value, democracy, mm-hmm. free economy, human rights. But this day, although Trump administration emphasized expansion of the U.S. Cooperation in the region in the name of a free and open in the Pacific, but the U.S. emphasized what? America first. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to work together under the name of America first. Mm-hmm. No, we must emphasize the value, which is country like South Korea, easy to join and easy to support. Mm-hmm. So I think, I believe that the Trump administration's free and open in the Pacific strategy is now kind of formulating, and they adding more plan. So I think, I hope United States think more about the value issue. Mm-hmm. Then it will be much easier to bring other partners into the free and open in the Pacific strategy. Mm-hmm.
And another question I wanted to ask you, obviously the New Southern Policy is the second most important foreign policy issue for the Moon administration. The most important one is North Korea, mm-hmm. how to deal with North Korea. So this U.S.-China competition or rivalry, how do you think from a South Korean perspective affects the potential for peace, denuclearization, or inter-Korean reconciliation, for example?
I think from the beginning, division of two Korea, there is a kind of influence of big powers. Uh-huh. Now, in the time of a Cold War period, the big power is the United States and Soviet Union. Nowadays, it is the United States and China. You know, these days, you probably noticed the delay of the nuclear negotiation between United States and North Korea. And North Korea's position is getting tougher and tougher. I believe that's because of Chinese influence. Mm-hmm. When from the China's perspective, northern part of Korea is their own territory of influence. You know, probably some of you remember that early 2017, when Trump administration inaugurated, President Xi Jinping visited the United States, they had a summit at the Mar-a-Lago, Florida. Mm-hmm. At the time, President Trump explained what President Xi Jinping mentioned about Korean Peninsula and said, it's quite a shock that Korea was a part of China for a long time. Who teaches history to Xi Jinping? Anyway, that's Chinese understand. They don't want to lose North Korea to the United States. So they cannot but support North Korea, not to leaning toward North Korea. That's the core of the matter of nuclear negotiation. You know, when President Trump met Kim Jong-un 3 times, Kim Jong-un visited China 4 times, and Xi Jinping visited North Korea 1 time. They have 5 summits. And then the term that the China and North Korea is a traditional ally revived. You know, the President Xi Jinping didn't even meet North Korea, Choi Ryong-hae, in year 2012 and 2013, because Choi Ryong-hae, the number second person of North Korea, when he visited China, he must pledge to that North Korea's devotion to denuclearization. Mm-hmm. That's the Chinese position year 2012, 2013. But as time goes by, South Korea tried to kind of... what is the 중재? I mean the mediation between the North Korea and United States, mm-hmm. and President Trump accepted South Korea's mediation and directly met North Korea. That is kind of a concern of China. Mm-hmm. So China cannot but to meet Kim Jong-un, and they cannot but to provide the support to Kim Jong-un. I'm not sure whether the report was right, but last June when President Xi Jinping visited Pyongyang, Asahi Shimbun reported that China pledged to support that 800,000 tons of grain and 2 million tourists to North Korea. Mm-hmm. No, 3 days ago, North Korea, the chairman Kim Jong-un mm-hmm. visited the Geumgang Mountain, mm-hmm. and then he called that the Hyundai Asan, which is as the counterpart of Kumgangsan tourism with North Korea. And the North Korean government provide 50 years the right of development to Hyundai Asan. Mm-hmm. But Kim Jong-un just nullified the kind of guarantee. And North Korea would develop the Kumgang Mountain with their own. I believe that that is also a connection with the Chinese tourist. No, with that kind of... No, interesting is that we try to block every economic loophole to North Korea to bring North Korea to the negotiation table for denuclearization. Mm-hmm. Only one loophole was tourism. Mm-hmm. We didn't know that. But anyway, there is no UN sanction to prohibit the tourism to North Korea, but China detoured the kind of sanction. So probably there are many Chinese tourists at this moment and going to increase. That is kind of a Chinese negative impact on nuclear negotiation. So Kim Jong-un, you know, North Korea unlawfully, illegally developed nuclear weapon. Nowadays, if you read North Korea's term, they believe that their nuclear development is justifiable because of the United States' pressure, hostile policy. Their position is now looking at the more like upper hand. Mm-hmm. That's because I think China's role. So from the beginning on the Korean matters, United States should solve this matter with China first. Without the cooperation with China, from China, it's very hard to solve North Korean problem. So this day, there is a possibility of a small deal, best small deal anyway. So North Korea just give a Yongbyon nuclear facility mm-hmm. instead of United States to provide a lift of several sanctions. But look at the nature of a negotiation. No, for the last 25 years, North Korea developed nuclear program, and look at their capability. They started to build the Yongbyon facilities and then other uranium enrichment facilities, and they produce nuclear fission material and they produce nuclear weapon. That's the leverage of North Korea's nuclear development. On the other hand, international community's response was establishing sanction step by step, increase the sanction. Mm-hmm. What North Korea tried to sell this time is selling their cheapest one. Facilities. What North Korea wanted to get? Most expensive and valuable one. The sanction over least 2 years. Mm-hmm. Not a long time ago years. That's the 2 weeks. So we changed the calculation in year 2013, started to pressure directly on the North Korea's economy. Mm-hmm. So this time, if United States accepted a step-by-step approach, with the sale of buying North Korea's nuclear facility, with the giving of a lift of a sanction, of a recent sanction, that was a mistake, I believe. So we must get the kind of a promise of North Korea. And so what is the end state of North Korea's denuclearization? That must be a North Korea give up all nuclear weapon and all nuclear facilities and all nuclear fission materials. We must get them from this kind of commitment. Mm-hmm. But North Korea never mentioned that kind of commitment these days. That mm-hmm. is, I think, a very risky negotiation.
Okay. One last question before we open up to the audience, maybe to Linda and Lynn. Maybe, Linda, we can start with Europe. Do you see any potential scenario under which Europe could strategically align with China? Because we still have NATO, obviously, that hasn't disappeared. It's not at risk, as far as we know. But do you see any possibility of Europe saying, okay, let's take a different approach and align with China?
In short, no.
Right. Next question.
No, I think that Europeans will never say, now we choose China over the United States. And I think there are many reasons for that. But I do think that it is possible because currently we don't really have, I would say, a very strong consensus on a European level on what the strategy then should be, mm-hmm. Although we are thinking about it and there's kind of a consensus that we should get a little bit tougher, but still I would argue that we're not quite there yet. So I do think that for as long as several countries in Europe remain interested in Chinese investments and in Chinese money, quite frankly, they will try to also keep it like this. And so for as long as we're not, for as long as we kind of remain divided, then I don't think we're really choosing China, but I think that plays well, that plays into China's hands. And of course, if then relations with the United States would deteriorate, depending on what happens also with the next administration, I think this could really work well for China. So I think even if we do not choose China, because I think we will never do that, and I hope we will never do that, I think it could be de facto that we are much less of an interesting partner for the United States than what the United States would like to see. But I'm also not necessarily saying that that's the direction we should take. So I don't think we will choose them, but I think that de facto it might actually work out quite well for China as it is right now.
And what about Southeast Asia? Is there any scenario in the where Southeast Asian countries or some of them might decide to align with China strategically?
I think at the moment what we've seen is a sort of reluctant acceptance of, at the moment, the United States' vision for the region, so the free and open Indo-Pacific. So in June, we saw ASEAN adopt an ASEAN outlook for the Indo-Pacific. It's a fairly anodyne statement. It doesn't say very much, but I think it seeks to, just by adopting the terminology of the Indo-Pacific, I think it's trying to buy into some of the principles that are outlined in the free and open vision or document. I would probably say that, Mr. Shin, I think earlier you mentioned that we need to, the United States needs to think about values more. I think it has outlined some values which I think are good for the region to buy into. So, you know, freedom means free and open Pacific means freedom from coercion, good governance, and then open means, you know, open seas as well as trading systems. And I think these are fairly easy principles for the region to buy into, and that's why they're important. But when we start talking about more values like, you know, democracy, human rights, I'm afraid that some countries in the region don't take kindly to references. And these are important values, but perhaps the best way of achieving these values might not be in a strategic document that seeks to win friends. I think what interested me in something that a Japanese diplomat said recently was that the failure to reference human rights in their national security strategy was really not a Trump failing. It was the success of Japanese diplomacy. So I think they lobbied, Japan lobbied for reference to good governance rather than human rights in the national security strategy. And I think that helps to achieve greater buy-in in Southeast Asia, at least for better or for worse. So some buying into the U.S. vision. That said, I think we are also seeing at the same time small but perceptible movements by the region towards greater alignment with Chinese interests and priorities. I think we see that in bilateral relations between China as well as countries like Malaysia and the Philippines. So President Duterte of the Philippines, as well as the former Prime Minister Najib, they were quite willing to, or rather they were very reluctant to push their country's South China Sea claims because they were hoping to get more Belt and Road deals from China. The current Malaysian administration under Prime Minister Mahathir is supposed to be more hard line against China, but even Prime Minister Mahathir has recently said that he prefers rich China over fickle United States. So you could not have a more clear statement than how China's rise and how its actions are actually influencing bilateral relations. And in terms of multilateral relations, I think China's increasing geopolitical influence is also showing itself, like in the European Commission, in its dealings with ASEAN. And I think a lot of us in the room would know that in 2012, China successfully leaned upon its ally, Cambodia, to leave out reference in the joint ASEAN statement to the South China Sea. What we probably have heard less of is how in 2016, China was able to successfully get Cambodia, Laos, but also a claimant in the South China Sea, Brunei, to say that the South China Sea issue is really a bilateral matter for the claimant states involved, and outsiders have nothing to say about it. So forget, you know, the right to freedoms of the seas, etc., and the right to legally permissible maritime rights in the South China Sea. These are all matters, according to China, that should be bilaterally dealt with between China and small countries. So we see China's geopolitical influence dividing ASEAN already, but we also have to worry about how China's growing geopolitical influence in the region might actually reach or make it easier for China to gain agreements that favor it. So in the code of conduct negotiations in the South China Sea that China is currently discussing with Southeast Asian countries and ASEAN, it's asking for certain very worrying provisions to be included in them. One of them is for external navies to not be able to conduct joint military drills or exercises with countries in the region unless there is permission given. And the second worrying provision as well is for countries in the region not to cooperate in the maritime economy with external, with companies from foreign countries. Mm-hmm. So China is seeking mm-hmm. to close off the South China Sea for anyone apart from China, the dominant power, as well as the smaller Southeast Asian countries. But by and large, though, I think that although there might be this tilt towards China, it's still taking place within the broader hedging strategies of Southeast Asian countries. And so far, at least, it has not meant a corresponding shift in security ties. So we see the Philippines maintain its alliance with the United States. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it's been strengthened with the U.S. Clarifying that reference to the Pacific in the Mutual Defense Treaty with the Philippines includes reference to the South China Sea. So that generally made the Philippines quite happy. We see, I'm told that, you know, U.S. surveillance planes continue to fly out of Malaysia, no problem. Singapore has signed on to the purchase of many more F-35s because we definitely need more toys. Vietnam, through its comprehensive partnership, has also been deepening its security ties with the United States. But I think in the long run, if we see the continuing economic integration, the economic carrots that China has to offer to a region that is in dire need of development and infrastructure development in particular, I find it very hard to believe that we can have this dichotomy between economic ties on the one hand with China and then security mm-hmm. ties on the other with the United States. I think there are tensions there already today, and moving forward, I think those tensions will come to a boil in the future.
If I can perhaps just quickly...
Very quickly, yes.
Yeah, just some of the things that she said I think are also very relevant actually from a European point of view, because if we indeed look at kind of public views of China, we also see that in the countries that receive a lot of Chinese investments or are in large need or in demand for these Chinese investments, we definitely see that actually public perceptions are still, I would not say positive, but more positive than in other areas of Europe. So in Western Europe, we see that perceptions have become increasingly negative. But in countries like Greece and Bulgaria, more than 50% of the population still has a positive view of China. And in Italy, for example, we've seen actually that perceptions have become more positive over the last year, which correlates also with Italy signing up on the Belt and Road Initiative. So I definitely think that we should also not underestimate that some of these countries simply are really looking for investment and simply are really mm-hmm. having economic troubles, and then China has a lot to offer. So then I also think that from their perspective, it might not be, I mean, it's also kind of comprehensible why they do this, and also similar because I don't precisely remember who said it, but the fact that it's rather difficult nowadays, the relationship with the United States. I also think there that for many Europeans, it's not very clear what precisely the United States is trying to achieve with China. Is it trying to decouple? Many analysts would say yes, but for example, last week then Mike Pence delivered a speech in which where he was very clear in saying no, we are not trying to seeking to decouple our economy. So I also think if perhaps the Americans or the administration would be a bit more clear in which are the areas of concern, that it might also get certain Europeans more on board, because these Europeans might not be interested in like some across-the-board, very confrontational approach, but might still share many interests and might still share many concerns and could, on individual aspects, still work together. And I think this is really an area where the current administration really missed this kind of an opportunity to get more support than it actually could because of that.
Okay. So now we're going to do like in the pre, and I already see four hands. So we can start by collecting maybe three questions here on the right-hand side, and then we can move to the left-hand side. And I saw a couple of you already there. If you can please introduce yourselves briefly.
I'm Steve Winters, independent consultant. Well, I'd like to direct this to, let's see, we got a Lynn Kwok, I guess I have to say. I had a number of many visits to Singapore, and a lot of those were with the U.S. Navy back in the day, at quite an interesting place in the Sembawang port and all this, a lot of history. But, so my question is, the U.S., in terms of this competition with China, is very concerned about China's announcement of this China 2025 and the areas of technology they were going to become number one in the world in by that time, and perhaps by 2030. What has been the reception in a country like Singapore to the Chinese plan for 2025, particularly given that Singapore is such an advanced technological society itself? I mean, do they fear this, or do they welcome it? Is this a good thing for Asia, a bad thing? Certainly in South Korea, it's greatly feared because Samsung thinks it'll just put them out of business.
Thank you. Had another one here and then another one there.
Thank you very much. I'm To Jun Jang from Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Actually, 200 years ago, the China took charge of 30% of world GDP, and now they are is on the way to reaching to the same position. So I think China is not just rising. They were just sleeping, and they are just on the way to wake up. So my question is, compared to that era, we have tons of alliances, and also some framework, and also some cooperative security platform to check and balance the China rising. So I think just reinforce and just supplement a little bit about the current system could be the optimal policy to counter about Chinese rising. So do you have any limitation on our current system?
I'm Alice Panier from Johns Hopkins SAIS. My question, in the interest of linking security dynamics in Europe and in Asia, relates to Russia-China relations. The French president has said we need to anchor Russia into Europe somehow, have this rapprochement to prevent them from, to not push them into the arms of China, basically. So I'm just curious, either from a European or an Asian perspective, what is the likelihood of any Russia-China denser security partnership.
Mm-hmm. Bongchul, maybe we can start with you.
No. Okay, let me start with the Russia-China relation. I think they are indeed in a cooperation of a strategic partnership. In the European matter, China supports Russia's position, I think. In the ASEAN matter, Russia supports China's position. With that kind of supporting mechanism, they compete with the United States. That might be an ultimate goal, two of them. Going back to the first question, because there's China's, considering the China's size and their economy and their capacity, I think that we should enforce the current system and mechanism. I think so. But there will be many challenges, because China is not stupid. They are very strategic. Mm-hmm. And they always think about the long-term strategic perspective. So they try to decouple the alliance mechanism and regional mechanism. When it comes to Rugged Alliance, China's demand, probably demand North Korea, that their goal of denuclearization, the first step is decoupling. So North Korea's perspective of the Korean Peninsula denuclearization concept, that was the retreat of USFK and dismantle of Rugged Alliance. Then that's the benefit of China. Maybe in the Southeast Asian country, I think almost the same. So it's not easy thing. It will be very tough. During that process, you must muddle through China's pressure. And then because of the China's market, it's not easy to refuse their proposal. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very difficult thing when you run the government, because the administration always evaluated the result of the economic situation, not the security situation. Because the security doesn't always give you a benefit. It always realized at the very difficult situation. But in ordinary time, always economic matters. So it's not easy. The first question is not mine. Okay.
Actually, the first one was for you, Lin, so maybe we can carry on with you now.
On Singapore's perception of China 2025, I don't have a clear idea of how it actually felt, how it actually thinks about the issue. But I think if one argues or reasons from first principles, I would say that Singapore would have no trouble with China seeking to develop itself as a technological power. But the problem is less the sort of capabilities that China has, but more its strategic intent that Singapore would worry about. And because I think there's a saying that the devil alone knows the mind of man, you can't actually tell what a country's strategic intent is short of what they say or what they do. And in this respect, I think China's actions in the South China Sea have been very worrying for Singapore, mm-hmm. as well as domestically, China's political influence operations seeking to influence parts of Singapore's population to China's cause, whether on the Belt and Road or the South China Sea, or just in terms of where China stands vis-a-vis competition with the United States. I think those are all red flags for the Singapore government. And I think if we look at two issues, let's just look at Hong Kong, how a lot of, I was actually surprised, I was back in Asia over the summer, and I was actually surprised by the sort of narratives that China has spun and people in the region believe. So when I first heard China accusing the United States of interfering in Hong Kong and hence leading to these protests, I thought, that's a silly story. No one's going to believe that. I've heard that in the South China Sea. Apparently, the U.S. is meddling, and that's why there are problems between Southeast Asian countries and China. I thought it was an absolutely silly story to spin in respect of Hong Kong, and I found it rather insulting for the 2 million or odd students and young protesters, or old protesters as well, fighting for a cause they believe in and against a regime that they didn't quite believe in. But there will be many in the business community in Singapore and other Southeast Asian countries that I have spoken to that actually believe this story. And they say, oh, now I get it. Now I know why these protesters are protesting when there's clearly no interest when they have no interest in doing so. It's because the U.S. is meddling. If we look at China's strategic intent, that's worrying, and we look at its actions, that's worrying, and we also look at how effective those actions are in persuading some of the local populace, that's also worrying. So that's a long way of answering your short question, and I don't know the actual answer to it, I'm just deriving from principles. And the other question was about Russia and China. I think we saw the Russia-China cooperation when, the two countries jointly conducted air drills above the East China Sea earlier this year. And that one had everyone in a frenzy about this potential Russia-China, support or grouping. But I think at the end of the day, Russia, at least at present, my reading of it is Russia is still very much a bit player in the region. I think its main influence in the region has been over, arms sales, but not so much its strategic position or role. And I think it's also quite interesting that in some respects, Russia and China have departed or are playing a game of almost brinkmanship, because Vietnam has quite savvily, remember I told you earlier how Vietnam was threatened by China for drilling and for oil and gas in its own exclusive economic zone. It was threatened when it was working with a Spanish company twice, and it was also threatened when it worked with a Russian company, Rosneft. And while Vietnam stopped drilling for oil and gas with its Spanish company, it continued, I think, with the Russian company, because the Russian company, I believe, is banking on the fact that China would not want to offend its only friend in the South China Sea, namely Russia. But for how long this is going to continue, because, you know, Russia's basically drilling for oil and gas in Vietnam's EEZ, but China thinks it belongs to China. For how long that you know, can continue, and how long, you know, China and Russia can remain bedfellows in this respect is an open question.
I think I can just add a little bit on this separate question, perhaps actually also on the industrial question. I think it also kind of, but it's not only a reaction to China, but I think it's also triggered some reaction in Europe, in a sense that because precisely this technological and this Huawei issue has now really come at the forefront on this competition between the U.S. and China. I think this has also partly led to kind of a renewed debate on an EU industrial policy. I mean, this is not a new issue, but now I feel like there's a renewed debate also perhaps on creating some sort of European industrial champions to be able to compete with Chinese companies, but also actually to some extent with American companies. So I do think it has actually also triggered a reaction outside of Asia. Then for the question on how to deal with China, so do we have to strengthen the current system? I would say yes, but I also think, although I'm not quite sure how that would work, that it also has to be adapted, because if we think, if we look at all these, I mean, I'm a big believer in multilateralism and all of that, but if we look at all these institutions, of course, they also reflect, I mean, they were set up in a different time when China was simply not as powerful and when the power relations between these different players in these institutions were different. So I do also think that now the position that some countries have in institutions does not necessarily reflect the current power base they have. So I do think there's a mismatch there. So even if I think that I continue to believe in these institutions and I think that we should continue to strengthen them, I also think we should to some extent adapt them to better reflect actually how the world has evolved, because otherwise I think you also create situations in which countries like China will just start building alternative institutions next to it, and then smaller countries don't have anything to say anymore. And then finally, on the Russia-China partnership, so I'm really not an expert on Russia-China relations, and I think Lynn has already discussed quite a bit on this, but I think from a European perspective, of course, we could be somewhat fearful of a good relationship there, because if Russia feels that it's backed by China, this could embolden Russia to be somewhat more assertive in certain instances. But I think from a European perspective, if we want to add, I mean, if we want to look at the triangle between then Russia, China, and then bring the United States back in, I would also be perhaps not concerned, but at least interested in how the U.S.-Russia relationship develops, because there have been some people making the case for improved U.S.-Russia relations to kind of create a front or something along those lines against China. And I think in that respect, the United States might be willing. I mean, there are important constraints that is, and important political reasons and domestic reasons why I don't think this will happen tomorrow. But if it would kind of go in this direction, this could be, I think, detrimental to Europeans, because the United States might be willing to give Russia something in Europe that is perhaps not a vital interest for the United States in exchange for Russian cooperation on China, so to speak. And I think the INF story is somewhat of an illustration of this, I think, in the sense that the argument was also made by some people that by withdrawing from the INF, also because the administration is not all that keen on treaties and all of that, but by withdrawing from the INF, it was not as much about Russia, but it was also a lot about being able to develop these weapons in competing with China. So maybe the United States was thinking, okay, let's have some instability in Europe, but if it will strengthen our position in Asia. So I think this triangle can be looked at from different directions. And I think actually we're getting in a situation where everybody wants to line up with Russia.
Fair enough. We had 1, 2, 3 people. Yeah, next to you, actually.
Jeff Stacey from a previous administration. This whole event is really much more about China than Russia. I've got an article coming out that is much harsher on Russia than China. But be that as it may, first, Ms. Desrael, it may be too soon to talk about permanent shifts in the U.S. All of Donald Trump's Republican rivals and all of the Democratic slate would basically put things back the way they were. And on the Hillary campaign, we made a decision that her first trip, had she been elected, had Russia not interfered, would have been to Brussels for an unprecedented joint NATO-EU summit on the theme of democracy, and it would have been specifically aimed at Russia. So don't give up on us yet, but in light of the Asian slant to all of this, which is quite appropriate in another sense, Dr. Kwan and Dr. Shin, I'd like to ask you a couple of quick questions about some earlier strategic moves in the region. Was the, Dr. Shin, you mentioned the rebalance and the pivot, was this, as many Chinese nationals who are abroad and out of the reach of the Chinese state, we think, are almost unanimous in their view that the U.S. essentially caused the hardening in Beijing with the rise of Xi, the fact that he skipped over senior military commanders and hired all hardliners for each of the branches of the military. And then another one, the move on the outlets and the buildup of them was along the same lines, potentially, not in an ultimate sense, but an approximate sense. Was it the West's failure to stand up to Russia with regard to Ukraine that was perhaps the proximate reason that Xi decided it was time to move on those islands and essentially show us, in direct contravening of his promise to the Obama administration, that he would not do that and then finally advanced? What is your view on that?
Yeah, Ken Meyer, Court retiree. We frame our relations with China in terms of competition and rivalry. Do the Chinese frame the issue in the same sort of zero-sum terms?
Thank you for your insightful discussion today. This is Zhang Ho Li from South China Morning Post. Just a quick follow-up question about the China-Russia relations. Japanese media Kyoto today actually reported that China and Russia are currently undergoing a discussion to form a formal alliance, and China has already deployed Russian radar that can detect U.S. long-range missiles. I was just wondering, how do you think this would actually impact the U.S. alliance in the region? And also, what additional role do you expect Korea and NATO and Southeast Asian countries to play in this era of new alliance? Thank you.
Lynn, do you want to go first?
On the cause of China's buildup of these islands and rocks in the South China Sea, I don't know what I would place my finger on as the actual cause, but I do think, given how extensive and how integral it seems to be in China's interest, I don't think it was a reactive measure. I don't even think it was because the West failed to stand up to Russia and China is just going to proceed with it. I think that certainly didn't help, but I think China has been planning its moves in the South China Sea steadily. And so in 1995 already, it moved against Mischief Reef. And that was some decades ago. The United States didn't really feel it had skin in the game then. And so when ASEAN actually decided to make a statement about China's moves against Mischief Reef, which is a low tide elevation within the Philippines EEZ, the United States really had to be persuaded to make a strong statement against this Chinese action. And again, in 2007, we saw China start to threaten U.S. companies for drilling for oil and gas in Vietnam's EEZ. And at that point of time as well, this is all in WikiLeaks, at that point of time as well, the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam at that time was saying, you know, this is something you need to resolve bilaterally with China, and even though U.S. companies were in the fray. So I think it was China has been taking moves first quietly and largely unnoticed in the South China Sea, and then come 2013, it made its biggest move reclaiming this, these features. But I think it's all part of a bigger it's a bigger long-term plan.
So perhaps I can only say something if I understood the question correctly about NATO's role in Asia Pacific, or was that not at all the question? Was that the kind of the question? Yeah, okay, that was kind of the question. So when it comes to NATO's role in the Asia Pacific, I think my personal impression is that I don't really think there's going to be a role for NATO really physically in the Asia Pacific anytime soon, for different reasons. So first of all, I think, especially from a European point of view, the Asia-Pacific is still far away. And when it comes to security challenges for Europeans, those countries more in the east are way more concerned with Russia than they are with China. Those countries more in the south are then more interested in the Mediterranean, in North Africa, and all of that. So I think there's already a lot going on very close at home for NATO to actually then start stretching its resources even further into the Asia-Pacific. And I also think precisely because in Europe we do not have this as strong view on, I mean, definitely not a strong view on U.S., on strategic competition with China, that there might also be some reluctance on the part of some European countries to really start playing a role there, because they don't want to also create the impression that we're all ganging up on China, because there are several countries that are still very interested in maintaining positive relations with China. So it really depends on the individual country you're going to look at. So I think, first of all, I don't really think NATO has the bandwidth to do that, even if it would want to at this point. And second, I actually don't think it wants to, or at least that not everybody wants to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think, let me first say, I love China. I love China too much. Beyond my expectation. But anyway, China is improving, getting better. But under the Xi Jinping time, I think it confused its direction. So I hope China will find their own way to muddle through, getting for the better country. No, with regard to Russia, I think in Asian region, in particular Northeast Asian region, they want to play as a veto power. They understand their power is limited in Asian country. In the Far Eastern area, which is the eastern side of Siberia, only 10 million people live in that region. So their economic power is limited, and their even military power is not as before as the Cold War time. They retreat the major military facilities capability from the east right after Cold War. So they won't play as a veto power. Without the agreement or without the approval of Russia, no country in the region getting through their goal. And for example, in North Korean nuclear issue, Russia played a certain role. So they can hamper, they want to show they can hamper the negotiation. But that's the limited role of Russia. So they need a cooperation partner. That is China in Asian, Northeast Asian region. So second question is, China seek gerasim? China's understanding of international relations, whether there is gerasim? I think so. Because China believe that they tend to think about their history. Fast history of some kind of wonderful days of China. They are the center, the China, their Chinese country name is center country. They are the center of the world. So they believe that those time of a European country like UK and these days the US dominance over the world, it is from Chinese perspective, it is something not acceptable to them. So they wanted to restore their prosperity, their influence over 200 years ago, probably. So they think about the international relation more basically on the gerasim game. So they try to push United States away in their ASEAN Pacific region. That's my understanding. And then the discussion forming alliance between the China and Russia. No, nominally, China opposes any type of alliance. That's their argument, because that kind of alliance system hurt the other partners, the other countries' security. So I believe China would not make a formal alliance treaty with Russia. However, things are changing. Maybe 5 years later, 10 years later, the position might be changed. The effect of that kind of a change bring United States more opportunity to make a more cooperation with the alliance partner, because those countries in the region all fear about China's influence, and the alliance between China and Russia getting more influence over the region, they can bring more fear over that kind of influence. However, there's one challenging thing, that is U.S. sentiment of isolationism, retrenching. Because, you know, the President Trump unilateral withdrawal at the Syria, that is a kind of issue, that whether we can trust the United States. Many people in South Korea start to think about that. So I believe the United States need more commitment. Not America first, maybe America second. Then United States still maintain number one in the world.
Ling, we are going to give the final word. Do you want to add?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to touch on that and then make my point. I don't think the issue necessarily is America first, because I think, you know, lots of countries put themselves first, and I think that's the whole point of national interest. You know, America first is almost normal. Singapore first, Malaysia first, I mean, that's normal. The problem with America first, in my view, is that President Trump or his administration has taken a very narrow and short-sighted view of what puts America first. And I think, you know, the issue of, you know, the rule of law, like, you know, not talking about international law as much, you know, it's issue of multilateralism. Those are all problems with the America first approach, not the actual America first policy that is the problem. And I wanted to touch, I didn't answer the gentleman from the South China Morning Post, your question earlier on the role of, you know, countries like Japan or South Korea even. I look at them as a group of like the middle powers, I suppose, right? And in my view on the area that I work on, the South China Sea, what can be their role? So I think first and foremost, I think we need to have these freedom navigation operations, or I think I prefer to call them assertions of maritime rights and freedoms. These should be continued, and they should be done by as many countries as possible who have the capacity to do that. I think the importance of this is that it helps to take the sharp edges off just a U.S.-China competition in this respect. It shows that there are countries with skin in this game, that countries beyond the United States care about ensuring that the seas are open. So as many countries who have the capacity who are able to do that, I think that's important for them to do. In this respect, Germany talked about, there was some news about Germany sending a ship through the Taiwan Straits. Unfortunately, I spoke to some German officials who say that, no, that was misreporting, and they have no immediate intentions or near-term intentions to send a warship through the Taiwan Straits, which I think is unfortunate. The other country I would like to see more from, especially, is India, because India is a so-called Asian country, and China's been making this point about how, you know, we Asians can look after ourselves, you know, but if India is involved in this as well, it shows that India, too, disagrees with how China is viewing the South China Sea as a Chinese lake, and I think that's important. On top of these assertions of maritime rights and freedoms, we need to have joint military exercises. More of them are a good thing. I think in May or June, South Korea was actually involved with the United States, Japan, South Korea, and I think it was, which was the other country, Australia as well. So the three quad countries as well as South Korea. And I think that's very important that these joint drills take place, because as I mentioned earlier, under the code of conduct, China is trying to seek to exclude external powers from conducting military exercises in the international waters of the South China Sea. Second, capacity building. We need countries, middle powers, to help with capacity building in the region. As much as the region can absorb, it should be helping. And I think this is important to deter problematic actions in the South China Sea, but also to build up the confidence of regional countries in its dealings with China. Third, I think China should, these middle powers have a role. If they might not have enough military might, they have very much, they have soft power, they have the powers of persuasion, and can they seek to persuade China that its long-term interests as a growing military naval power and as a country that increasingly has interests across the globe, both economic as well as military interests across the globe, its interests lie in preserving freedoms of the seas. And so, you know, middle powers who have that sort of background and experience, they can provide a persuasive force, knock until the door opens, right? And then the fourth way, I think, you know, middle powers can contribute to regional stability and the rule of law is that they should help with promotion. And this goes broader than the South China Sea. They should help with promotion of development in the region that has dire need for infrastructure development and broader development goals in general. Because how countries decide to position themselves vis-a-vis China or the United States, or even how they position themselves in terms of adherence to the rule of law, will depend on how they view the strategic winds, strategic and economic winds as blowing. And insofar as, you know, middle powers and the United States and its allies and partners are able to convince countries that, you know, there is a future with us and it's a stable and law-abiding future, then, you know, these countries would feel more reassured about, you know, lending its hand to this cause.
Thank you very much. On that note, I want to thank a few people. I want to thank the panelists for the stimulating discussion. I want to thank Jung and her team and Brookings in general for hosting us as an institute for the support and for hosting us in Seoul next year. And the Institute for European Studies for giving me a job, I guess, and for supporting this initiative as well. And thanks to all of you for being with us this afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.